This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Welcome to One Party Rule. The voters have spoken. The country is about to change direction like turning on a dime. So the question becomes, are people prepared? And can Donald Trump pull it off? What did the voters say yesterday, and how will it play out at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, on Capitol Hill, on Jones Street, and on Main Street? We're joined by WFAE News reporter Tom Bullock, who has been covering the election results since last night. I don't think he's slept.
Okay. I did for about an hour and a half. I'm good.
Okay. Jim Morrill has also been involved in watching the results come in. He's a reporter, obviously, for the Charlotte Observer. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
And we have two political scientists in our midst. For them, this has been like Christmas morning. But like Christmas morning, once the presents have been unwrapped, all they want to do is clean up and take a nap.
Please.
Dr. Susan Roberts is here. She's professor of political science at Davidson College. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Dr. Michael Bitzer, who helped us bring you election results last night on WFAE, must have spent the night here. He's provost and professor of political science at Catawba College. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Given what we know now has happened in this race and in Senate races around the country, what message did voters send yesterday?
Anger.
Yep.
Anger and resentment. If you look at the exit polls, both in North Carolina and nationally, over two-thirds of the respondents said that they were either dissatisfied or angry with the federal government. And guess who they voted for?
What are they angry about?
It boils down mostly to the economy, if you don't mind me jumping in. I mean, if you look at one of the more interesting trends that we saw here in North Carolina and also nationally, it breaks down to the basic core question of the American dream. Do you think your kids will do better economically than you did? And Trump supporters, by a wide margin, said no. And you saw that, I think, in exit polls pretty much everywhere. I mean, other key issues were immigration, terrorism. But the key thing here may just boil down to a core economic argument that voters were angry at the federal government, did not like the direction it was going. They're angry with trade, and they wanted to basically just start all over.
And what does that mean? They're angry at the direction the country is going in. I mean, what does that mean? The economy is up. Unemployment is down. What are they angry about?
Well, I think Jennifer Hochschild just wrote a book called Do Facts Matter? And people have said we live in a post-factual world in which those numbers don't mean anything.
And clearly a post-data world, because the polls got it 100% wrong. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I think, that's the thing that people are saying. Oh, he had, Reince Priebus had such a great micro-targeting machine. Uh-huh. And then on the other hand, we're saying the polls got it so wrong, what could happen? And I think the truth lies somewhere in between. We don't know yet why the polls were
misleading. I think it was America's Brexit. Nobody who watches the polls and listens to the pundits saw this coming at all. I was watching Morning Joe yesterday morning. And everybody was expecting a Clinton victory, even the Republican consultants that they had on. So,
but not Joe Scarborough. He's been saying this for weeks, that this was going to happen.
Well, I thought he still expected a Clinton
maybe,
to win.
But I'm telling you, he was talking about that this
but
morning.
He said not to underestimate Trump.
And I
think that's what a lot of people did, simply because it is a contest between the haves versus the have-nots in a general sense.
But is this something caused by politicians and policy, and is it something that can be fixed by politicians and policy?
I think that actually feeds in with what I was just trying to say, going back to Susan's point. What this boils down to, if you really start digging through the numbers, the most important, one undeniable fact in this election may simply be wage growth or the lack thereof. We finally saw baseline wages grow for the first time earlier this year since roughly, 2000? So even with unemployment numbers down, even with the general economy doing well, a lot of people did not see any corresponding bump in their paycheck. So to them, their direct world, the economy was terrible. That was their anger point. That is exactly where it goes. And, you know, on polls, this is fascinating to me, because if you stop and look at, I mean, we were talking about this last night, Michael. If you go back and you look at some major, major races in developed world countries where you have really well-run polls, you think about this election from last night, Brexit, as you mentioned, Mike. Scottish referendum is another one, the Israeli Knesset, David Cameron, parliamentary elections where, you know, his party was expected to, you know, lose some a good number of seats, but they actually ended up sweeping. Those are just five things off the top of my head, all broken polls. Every single one of them called it wrong.
And all populist anger all over the world that relates in some to sovereignty and trade, global trade, and mm-hmm. lack of jobs and lack of income for middle-income people. Mm-hmm. Given the demographics of who voted for Donald Trump, and it was obviously clearly a lot of white men and many white women, as mm-hmm. about, but it's clearly white. Is this sustainable? Is this the last gasp of the old America as we move toward an America that by 2050 will be majority minority?
Well, I think you're right. It's 2040, 2050. To talk about unity, and that was a shrinking dynamic, the demographic, the white male vote. And I think now it's anybody's game. I'm looking towards, the Hispanic vote, the Latino vote, the millennials, and I still don't know how the millennials turned out.
And I think Bernie Sanders warned about this, that the Democrats were ignoring the mm-hmm. white vote.
And Joe Biden has, too. And I think Donald Trump got a high percentage, a relatively high percentage of the Hispanic vote. It was 38% or so in North Carolina.
Yeah, and he won white women in North Carolina. He was expected to win white men, but he won white women, and by a healthy margin, not razor thin by any stretch. And when it comes to the Hispanic vote, I think one of the strange takeaways from last night, everybody expected his numbers with the Hispanic vote to crater. He actually, in a number of key states, including North Carolina, performed as well or slightly better than Mitt Romney did in 2012. Yeah. So the trick when we come and we are, you know, eventually will be a majority minority country with the Hispanic voting bloc, we simply don't know their particular proclivities when it comes to political voting, because you can see lines where they could be attracted to Republicans. You can also see lines where they could be attracted to Democrats.
This is the first time in American history, I believe, that the electorate, no matter who they chose, we're going to choose the least popular candidate ever to run. They didn't like either of them. Is this something that's going to go on? Is this the wrong? Had Joe Biden been the Democratic nominee? Had Bernie Sanders been the Democratic nominee, would we be talking differently this morning?
Well, I think they're talking about some of the news media about Sanders as a reason to say this is why Trump won. But I think if you look back, political scientists will say it's no longer ideology or issue, no longer issue proximity. But one very rational way to vote is by trustworthiness and honesty. And that's what's perplexing, because this election, neither one of those was a predictor. So I think it must go back to something about the economy, because that's now a sophisticated vote to say, I want to know who's going to represent me in the next administration, no matter what the agenda is going to be.
Hindsight. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
On the exit polls, the question was asked, is Hillary Clinton qualified to serve as president? 50% of North Carolinians said yes. Same question. Is Donald Trump qualified to serve as a U.S. president? 43% said yes.
And yet
in North Carolina.
He wins the state by 3 points.
He wins the state.
So qualification didn't
be
matter.
Be damned.
Amazing. Hindsight being 2020, a lot of people on this program and many other programs sat around these tables and talked about the reckoning that the Republican Party was going to have to go through, mm-hmm. whether he won or whether he lost. Is that the wrong question? Should the question now be, what are the Democrats going to do? They're shut completely out.
I think both questions are going to be asked by both parties for very specific reasons. When you win the presidency and the House and the Senate in what clearly should be considered a Republican wave election here, because let's not forget that the Republicans were expected to lose control of the U.S. Senate. The House was always out of reach, but the Senate, mm-hmm. that was supposed to tip. You really, they're going to have to decide if this is in fact their new path. But the Democrats are really fascinating, because if you look at congressional elections, 2008, midterms, presidentials, they have not done great. The real energy on the Democratic Party seems to be on the left. It seems to be with Bernie Sanders. It seems to be with Elizabeth Warren. There is no great moderate of the Democratic Party. So now they have to decide, do we start going where the energy is, Or do we look to build what is a depleted bench? Because frankly, Joe Biden is getting old. He's getting up there. I'm not sure he has a run in him. Hillary Clinton, I think it's safe to say
it's done.
So who else do you have that can actually pull together a general?
Two dynasties were killed off in this election, the Bush dynasty and the Clinton dynasty, both done. I'm not sure. I've got so many questions going through my head. I don't even know where to begin.
Well, I think Bush, Clinton is very fascinating because he had a lot of the things that she had, the super PAC money, the name recognition, the organization, all things that would point to a successful run. And he fizzled before she lost.
And I'd be cautious, just to disagree with Tom a little bit, about the wave issue. By accounts right now, Hillary Clinton is still leading in the popular vote.
Right.
If you saw a true wave, that's the slam in the Electoral College, but it's also the slam in the popular vote. So I'd just be – I would be hesitant right now to say it's a wave to the Republicans. The Democrats have the issue, and I think they are facing the same thing that the Republicans have gone through in terms of moving to their extreme, the right or to the left. Bernie Sanders is the canary in the coal mine for this year to say to the Democrats, it's time to move to a more comfortable base made up more of liberals. Republicans are going to have to face the problem of populist Trump with establishment congressional leadership. And tell me how that dynamic plays out over the next 4 years.
You're right. There's not all sweetness and light in the Republican Party. I mean, you're going to see an interesting election for Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House. Should he run again, which he probably will, I'm sure there will be a little uprising among conservatives in the House against him.
Didn't
they already threaten that when he wouldn't endorse Trump? I mean, he voted for Trump, but he wouldn't endorse Trump.
Even when he was, won the speakership, he was already under siege.
So we're a completely divided nation this morning, and yet Donald Trump last night tried to heal that wound. That would be the cut.
I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans. And this is so important to me. For those who have chosen not to support me in the past, of which there were a few people, I'm reaching out to you for your guidance and your help so that we can work together and unify our great country.
How does he do that?
Who knows?
I think that's the great question. Who does he put in his cabinet? Does he reach out to the rest of his party, or does he surround himself with the Rudy Giulianis, the Newt Gingriches, the Chris Christies?
They were the backbone of his campaign.
They were. And presidents get to reward. They've got the spoils. The question is, can he broaden within his own party to, bring in some of those folks?
And I think one thing that should give us pause is that winning is not governing.
Right.
And I think we need to look carefully at what that win means in terms of translating. People were saying, did Donald Trump really want to be president or did he want to be elected president? And I think the next few days, the next 100 days, but the issues are there and it's not going to change. They've already said we're going to build a wall and repeal Obamacare. We've got those things ready to go on day one.
And they do. And to clarify my last comment, if Hillary Clinton had won last night, I would have said the same thing. This country is that divided, that polarized. But the interesting thing is he also has, again, control of the Senate and control of the House. So a lot of the things that we all said, there's no way you can do that unless Congress goes along. Right now, it's looking like he's got that path.
Well, wouldn't that depend on whether this is viewed as a mandate? And we'll talk about that when we come back, because it's a very – she's won the popular vote pretty much.
So did John Kerry.
We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Firehouse Casual Living Stores, serving the Carolinas for nearly 40 years with branded outdoor patio seating and dining furniture. Showrooms located on Johnston Road and W.T. Harris Boulevard. Details at fhcasual.com. And Blumenthal Performing Arts presenting First Date, the Broadway musical about a guy and a girl on a blind date and all the voices in their heads. Now playing at Booth Playhouse through November 20th. Tickets at 704-37 800-922-1000. Tomorrow on this program, we take a look at the polls for this election cycle to talk about why they were so different from the actual results around the country. In fact, 100% wrong. We'll also be joined by financial experts to talk about financial market turmoil here and around the world following this election. That's tomorrow at 9.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, morning after analysis of the 2016 presidential election, plus what exit polls and results by region suggest about priorities and challenges for the next administration.
Coverage of the election continues with the Ian Rehm Show following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about yesterday's election and what the voters have said. Dr. Michael Bitzer is here from Catawba College, Dr. Susan Roberts from Davidson College, Jim Morrill from the Charlotte Observer, a political reporter there, and Tom Bullock from WFAE News. So Hillary Clinton at the moment is ahead in the popular vote, but clearly the Electoral College went to, and that's the only thing that matters, went to Donald Trump. But is this a mandate?
Well, they always claim it's a mandate. But I think if you look at the map in terms of, you know, how red it was, he's going to claim a mandate. And his supporters, and he talks about it as a movement. If you talk about it as a movement, that translates into a mandate that he's going to claim. There is no, Kellyanne Conway was saying today, it was the arrogance of the Democrats. You can't say that Trump was not arrogant. And so I think that this is going to be one of the things he will claim a mandate from day one.
And is this a movement or is he really a Republican? That's the question. You have a Republican Congress, but is he really a Republican or is he the leader of a movement that has challenged both parties?
I think the latter.
Yeah.
You know, he.
So will they cooperate? Because there's some Republicans who may not like what he wants to do.
Well, that's true, but Republicans have to cooperate.
Do they?
They do for this reason. They do for this reason. At least he will get a honeymoon, in my opinion, with Congress, simply because when you are a Republican president and you pull off wins in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio, North Carolina, and Florida, Michigan looks still likely to go, although it has not been called, at least while we were taping this. You cannot be in the way of that if you are a congressperson, because what you're hoping, if you're a Republican, because what you're hoping is this is, in fact, redefining a map. It's a redefining your party. And I do want to correct myself, because right before the break I said the wrong person who won the popular vote. I should have said Al Gore instead of John Kerry. My apologies.
But if he wants to build the Republicans got together and did a postmortem 4 years ago and said we have got to appeal to a broader coalition. He went after every single and criticized heavily every single element of that coalition. Are Republicans who are lifetime politicians, not Donald Trump, who is a 9-month politician, going to be willing to put all of that at risk after they had their big postmortem and go and build that wall? And deport 11 million immigrants and restrict people coming into the country from Muslim countries? Are they going to be willing to do that, to alienate those people?
The post-2012 GOP autopsy is dead.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they don't have to appeal to minority groups.
Is
they don't have to broaden.
Is that short-sighted?
Well, if you take the long view, I would argue yes, because again, as has been the refrain this year, demography is destiny, where the country is moving. But they were able to put together a coalition of white voters who show up at higher rates than other groups and were able to win. Why should you have to change if you win?
All the stars in the Democratic firmament were out there for Hillary Clinton, particularly in the final days.
Pennsylvania.
What happened to the great blue firewall?
You know, it may be like the Obama coalition that in the end couldn't be reassembled. Yeah. I don't think the Trump coalition could necessarily be reassembled by any other Republican. You have to be in touch with the people that he's mobilized, the voters in rural areas, suburban areas. So it's a movement.
And maybe we are talking about a personality-led presidency, that it is about the core of the individual, not necessarily policy, not necessarily anything else that we as political scientists know or have seen in the research. It's all about charisma and the individual.
They knew that Hillary Clinton was not connecting with African Americans, and President Obama pretty much went out there in the last week or so and said, you need to go out to the votes to fellow African Americans and vote, because this is a referendum on my presidency. So therefore, the question becomes, is what happened yesterday a repudiation of his presidency?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think you alluded to this, and that is all the get out the vote efforts cannot overcome the enthusiasm gap. And that's what the Republicans had over the Democrats all the way through. They were more excited about voting for Trump, the Republicans, than the Democrats voting for Hillary. And I think that gives us pause, too. I'll just put this out there before we forget, and that is the midterms. President usually loses seats in the midterm, not when you see how many seats the Democrats are going to be defending in 2018. And so I don't know exactly. It's about the same number that Republicans were defending this time.
Some analysts are comparing this to Ronald Reagan's slapdown of the elites, the political elites, when he won in the 80s?
Yes. Yep. Back in the day.
And presidential historian Michael Beschloss says this upset is comparable to but bigger than Andrew Jackson's election, which was a populist election as well. You agree with that?
Yeah. I think the key difference between Reagan and Trump is that Reagan was a successful two-term governor of California, and he knew how to work within the governing system. Mm-hmm. He was willing to cut deals. He had principles. He had an ideology. He had a world vision. He was able, though, to work with Tip O'Neill as speaker and get things done. He went against his own ideals oftentimes and raised taxes even after the great tax
and the amnesty.
And the amnesty. Can Trump do the same thing? We have to wait and find out.
So Nicole emails, what elections in recent history can be considered mandates for change? And have we seen the resulting promised change in the light of those mandates? It seems to me that if one wins by a slim margin, it can hardly be considered a mandate. If the popular vote and the Electoral College vote do not align, it can hardly be considered a mandate. This year, it seems that the most people voted against, not for. This is not a mandate. It is disgust.
Well, I think the president's going to claim a mandate, whether it exists or not. And again, you said, you know, the Republicans, winning is everything. And so they're going to work with him to the extent that they need to get things passed. They don't really, in many ways, they don't need Donald Trump.
I want to go back to the repudiation question, because he has promised on day one, January 20th, Obamacare is history. He's going to build that wall. He's going to renegotiate many of our alliances around the world, take different tacts in foreign policy and military activity, make these countries that we have military bases in since 1945 start paying for that, or we're going away. Is that a repudiation not only of Obama, but of everything that's come before Obama since Franklin Roosevelt?
We honestly cannot answer that question yet for a very simple reason.
Is that what the country wants?
Well, it's certainly, if you believe that they voted for Trump on every single issue, then yes, that's what the country would want. But I don't personally believe that. I think really there are very few people who vote in 100% agreement with their candidate of choice. I think the more important question here, though, and I'll use a comparison with President Barack Obama. Day one, he was supposed to start closing Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. It is still open. It will be open after he leaves office. A lot of the things you just talked about are really difficult to unwind, Obamacare being one of them. If you note the rhetoric, Mike, it's not just tear it down, it's repeal and replace. So we know they have the votes now to repeal it. No question about that. But that does leave a chunk of Americans uninsured, and they've always kept saying, and Trump too, replace it with something better. So they've got to come up with a different system. If you look at the strategy involved militarily in negotiations, whether it's trade or alliances, that also takes a lot of time to try to figure out. I don't think you're going to see those kinds of things in 100 days. I do think you'll see him repeal quite a few of President Obama's executive actions. And I do think he will, as promised, put a freeze on EPA regulations. Those are easy because they are in his purview directly. But the rest, he's got to figure out here. It's you're not running a business. You are part of a machine that takes time to move, and you have to know how to get the process done.
There was a lot of hand-wringing about the tenor of this presidential campaign and the fact that a lot of lies were told by both sides, I suppose, but certainly by his side, and the fact that the political discourse had really degraded. Not the least of which is the Access Hollywood tape that we all had to listen to time and time again. How do we go on from here? Is this a new country? Is this a different country? Will we ever go back to campaigns and political conversations as we knew them, where you could have a conversation with someone with whom you disagreed and go away friends? Or is now everything, if you don't agree with me, you are my enemy?
I don't think we can go back. And I think one thing is indisputable. No matter what the election results, polarization and partisan antipathy is still there. And that's been going on in the last decade, that polarization has increased. And I don't see how we can go about and say that we're not going to get rid of negative campaigning. I don't know that it really proved to be the instrument for Donald Trump to win. But if you see, you know, it was very easy to me for the Hillary Clinton campaign to use his words against him. And just want to throw this in there about the 100 days.
It didn't matter, though.
No. But they asked Kelly Conway.
That means we can say any damn thing we want, right?
Well, more or less.
And use any word that we want.
But I think we talk about those first 100 days. And Kelly Conway was on television this morning, and she was asked, what about his promise to get a special prosecutor against Hillary Clinton? Mm-hmm. And she said, we didn't talk about that. And she, you know, she just left it at that and didn't say, oh, you know.
We didn't talk about that in the campaign or
didn't
last talk
night.
About it back
we
behind
didn't
the
last
scenes.
Night.
And,
last night.
Yeah. That will be one of the hallmarks. If we're going to have a contentious 4 years and an ugly 4 years.
Lenora emails, your analysis is missing a major component of his victory. I am not a Trump supporter, but I live in Gaston County and attend an evangelical church. Many of my fellow evangelicals held their nose and voted for Trump, feeling that they had no other choice. Abortion and the Supreme Court are the only issues upon which they base their vote.
But they also just hated Hillary. There was a hate for Hillary among evangelicals.
Yes.
Because the evangelicals went for Cruz in South Carolina. I mean, went for Trump in South Carolina.
Explain that, because she stuck with her husband after a really tawdry period in their lives. He has been married 3 times.
I can't explain that.
I think everybody's been trying to explain. It's not just Susan.
Doesn't matter.
It's one of those things where it just boils down to what is going to tip the scale and make me move. I mean, yeah, they're not going to love a casino magnate who's been divorced 3 times. And
The Mormon state of Utah went for him last night.
It did. And that actually, you know, Utah, that's actually my home state. I know a decent amount about it. But the question in Utah was not whether or not it would go Republican. It's which Republican would it go for? You know, would it go for the write-in candidate or would it go – or the third-party candidate in essence, or would it go for Donald Trump? And they eventually came home. I mean, in Salisbury a few weeks ago, we had Mike Pence giving a rally, and he said something that I thought was incredibly interesting. And I think this is where things started to turn, not because of this speech, but this speech coincides with it. He kept telling everyone at every stop, it's time for Republicans to come home. It's time to put this behind you. It's time to look at the issues, the Supreme Court, abortion, the fact that I'm running, you know, my running mate is running against a Clinton. It's time to come home. And guess what? A large margin, they did. This great defection didn't really show up.
And John emails, this is not an anomaly, nor is it an uprising of uneducated voters. That's all he says. So then what is it? If he's right about that, what is it?
Well, I think it's what Tom said. I mean, I think Republicans did come together in the end for the reasons that y'all alluded to, the Supreme Court being a big one. You know, it's just amazing, you know, how divided Republicans were at the convention and afterwards.
We didn't turn the bums out. I mean, people were upset with the political elites, and except for the top of the ticket, they didn't turn the bums out. They're all back in, and more so, they're in more control. Mm-hmm. Why? Explain that.
I think part of it is that we know if one self-identifies with a party, you're going to vote 90% of the time for that party. So last night in North Carolina, Democrats, 91% for Hillary Clinton. Republicans, 94% for Trump. I mean, it's just – it's ingrained in who and what we are. Mm. And that partisanship, and then independents went 54 to 40 for Trump.
And that's fascinating.
And that's
where we need to attract our attention. The unaffiliated, because usually the independents are the ones that we say, well, a true independent is not going to vote. I want to see what happened last night because obviously they did. And I want to see the exit polls that say why.
Yeah, and also to the listener's comment, you know, in North Carolina specifically, Trump won college educate in, you know, some subgroups, you know, not writ large. I'd have to pull up the number really quick to break it down. But it isn't just this kind of idea of an angry white former factory worker. He won a large swath of the population in surprising fashion.
Well, and if you listen to Hillary Clinton's opening statement, more or less in the last debate, she was dead straight on, said, I'm going to protect, not even protect abortion rights. I'm going to keep the government out of your life reproductively. She said in the same like three or four sentences, paragraphs about who she was going to support as a Supreme Court justice. I think if I look back at that, that's going to really say these are the issues that rose to the top.
You and Tim Funk, Jim Morrill, wrote on November the 5th that never before has North Carolina played such a pivotal role in American politics. Did that turn out to be the case, or did it turn out to be Michigan and Wisconsin?
Well, during the campaign, it seemed like North Carolina. Last night, it seemed like Michigan and Wisconsin. But we've never seen anything like this in North Carolina in terms of the visits by presidential candidates, the attention, the money spent, and Secretary Clinton outspent Trump here by like 2-1 on the air, and Roy Cooper spend a lot more than Governor McCrory did, too. We can talk about that race. But, I think it's still a pivotal state. But when you talk about it being a purple state, the facts start to belie that anymore.
And in Florida, I think somebody mentioned this already, Donald Trump did better than Mitt Romney did 4 years ago. And Hillary underperformed a historic Democratic performance, even in the highly populated counties. And there's a lot of Latino vote down there. Why? What happened there?
I think we're going to have to continue to dissect it and try and figure that out. But certainly what Donald Trump got was the royal flush. He got Florida, he got North Carolina, he got Pennsylvania, and then he picked up Wisconsin and Michigan. And that was the straight that he needed.
And he got Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan in areas that had really gone for Barack Obama.
Right.
4 years ago,
but eight years ago. But think about the economies in those states, particularly with Ohio. You know, we refer to them as the Rust Belt. Trump's message played to those states, and it was clear what he was going after, and they went after it.
And you just couldn't get the urban areas. You had to get the hinterlands. You had to get the rural vote, and he did that.
Yeah. Guy emails, why would the Democrats nominate someone with so much baggage? Is their bench that shallow, or was it that she's the heir apparent?
Well,
she had the right to run?
Well, I mean, it's a combination of things. Let's not forget that at one time, in fact, here in Charlotte, when Joe Biden came down with Anthony Fox to talk about, you know, Amtrak, it really felt like more of a test run for his political campaign. Joe Biden, I truly believe, obviously, was doing a big soul search on whether or not he wanted to run, and then his son died. And he just came out eventually and said, it's not, I don't have it in me. I think the fact that everybody knew that Clinton was going to run again. I don't think anybody in the Democratic Party did not see that coming. Bernie Sanders, Martin O'Malley, the former governor of Maryland, those two kind of popped up out of nowhere. But Biden was the big question mark. Yeah. And, you know, that, I think, is why you didn't have an Elizabeth Warren running. You didn't have anybody else running. And let's face it, the Republicans control most of the governor's offices in the country. So
when we come back, we'll talk about our governor's office and what's going on in that race, because it's
not over.
Not over. Not really over. And Tim Boyum will join us as well. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and TRCW, a specialty shop for women built and headquartered in Charlotte in Phillips Place, featuring American and European clothing and accessories for women of discriminating taste. Details at trcstyle.com. And Hollins University, dedicated to producing graduates with confidence, leadership skills, and drive, whatever the career, research, lab, classroom, or the stock exchange. Hollins works to provide the path. Hollins.edu. Donald Trump elected as the nation's 45th president last night. What exit polls and results by region suggest about priorities and challenges for this next administration? That's the topic of the conversation coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. We'll be back with our panel of experts to talk about the presidential race and the outcome here in North Carolina as well. Stay with us.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
Now to the nation of Colombia, where Marxist guerrillas say they are ready to lay down their weapons. But there's a hitch here.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
An attorney for the North Carolina NAACP said the right to vote should not depend on responding to a mass mailing from a private party.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Jim Morrill from the Charlotte Observers, Dr. Susan Roberts from Davidson College, and Dr. Michael Bitzer from Catawba College. North Carolina obviously was a state with a key governor's race this time around, as well as a U.S. Senate race that had the nation's eyes glancing our way. Tim Boyum covers state politics every single day for Time Warner Cable News and is host of their Capital Tonight program, which is exclusively devoted to politics, and he joins us now by phone from Raleigh, if he's still awake. Good morning, Tim. Welcome.
Who needs more than 2 hours of sleep? Right?
So,
Trump doesn't.
In the governor's race, it's still 49%, 49%, and by the figure that I have in front of me, which I don't know how old it is, the race is separated by 4,772 votes.
5,101.
Oh, is it? It's gone up.
Yeah. 5,101.
So, with Roy Cooper in the lead. Roy Cooper made an acceptance speech last night, Tim. The governor said what?
The governor said, look, hold off. We got to let the process move through. We have provisionals that are outstanding, perhaps some other absentee issues. And then, of course, if it's less than a half per percentage point, we have an automatic recount in North Carolina. So the governor is just trying to step back. I do think a lot of Republicans were taken aback by what happened yesterday. My understanding was Roy Cooper didn't necessarily want to get out and say so pronouncedly that he was the victor in that race last night, but that's essentially exactly what he did, and then he left the stage. It was just a remarkable night, and I think a lot of Republicans are asking themselves, how did they get Richard Burr elected? How did Donald Trump win by such a large margin compared to the last two elections? And then Pat McCrory looks like he might lose.
Yeah, why were there no coattails? Or were there coattails? Would it have been worse if Hillary Clinton had won?
It's a tough question. I'll have to think on that one. But I do want to point out one thing, too, just to build off of Tim's point. Mm-hmm. If you look at Pat McCrory, Roy Cooper, both have 2.2 million and change in votes. Go down one slot. Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, He would have beaten them both last night, 2.3 million. So you almost wonder if the coattails skipped a step, if there were, in fact, coattails, or if McCrory is getting hit by something. And I have to say, Jim Puckett, who is Mecklenburg County commissioner here, he sent out a very interesting email, and I ran the numbers just to see if he was onto something here. And it's possible. I'm not saying this is the difference, but it is possible. It may all come down to I-77. Mm-hmm. And the toll lane project. And here's how. If you look at the precincts in North Mac, McCrory is underperforming 2012 numbers by about 22,000 and change. Mm-hmm. This is a race that is down to 5,101 votes. So that difference in Republican-heavy North Mac with the core of the fight against the I-77 toll project, it may actually have made Pat McCrory lose the governor's mansion. Now, we still have a lot that has to be counted, absentee ballots, the fights over provisionals, the canvassing, whatnot. But that was an interesting theory that was put out there, and the numbers kind of back it up.
So you're saying that the toll lane project in Mecklenburg County had more impact than HB2?
Oh, I think in North Mecklenburg County, as you're pointing out, these people, there were a lot of people that were mobilized to get out the vote, get out and vote, that had not voted before. And I guess you have to live up there to really appreciate how important it was to a lot of people that could have been, you know, shy Trump voters, but they didn't talk about it. This is the first presidential election without straight ticket voting. And I think that you could see how you can make a difference between the governors and looking at Richard Burr.
You know, we live here in Mecklenburg County, Tim, and you live up in, I guess, Wake County, Raleigh, in the Raleigh area. And for us, Pat McCrory is a homeboy. We're very intimately aware of his role here as in 14 years as mayor, and the progressive nature of his politics as mayor. You and the rest of the state have pretty much seen him be pretty conservative. Why didn't that play? Since it seemed to be rural versus urban, conservative versus liberal, why didn't that play?
Well, I do think, first of all, your point about rural and urban, I think that's the big story out of this election. And the reason Donald Trump won so well is that rural white voters felt like they have not been listened to, and they revolted this election. On the Pat McCrory front, I think he became a punching bag for all the issues that Democrats and a lot of these independents didn't like. He became the face of those problems, whether it's HB2, as you mentioned, the toll roads, and I think it was a cumulative effect over time. And I can tell you from talking to the Cooper campaign folks all the way last year when they were getting ready to announce that was their game plan. That it wasn't going to be one issue that was going to put Roy Cooper over the top as he beat Pat McCrory. It was going to be a cumulative effect of that the governor was ineffective. He just did whatever the legislature wanted to do, and that he was going to be the face of all these problems. And it appears at the end of the day that may have been a winning recipe.
But now you have a Democratic governor with a Republican-controlled legislature, which is something probably the Republicans like because they can really use him as a punching bag. They had to be a little careful with their own guy, right?
With a supermajority,
too. Well, yeah,
absolutely.
Too. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Bitzer. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say with a supermajority. So, I mean, Roy Cooper vetoes something, Republicans override it. Republicans are in control.
Right. And they don't have to say, well, we heard a Republican governor. Right. We heard a Democratic governor.
Right.
I think Tim's right about HB2 and all the things that the voters seem to use McCrory as a punching bag for. Look at Mecklenburg County. When he lost Mecklenburg County in 2008 to Beverly Perdue, he barely lost it, and he was very upset about that. In 2012, he won Mecklenburg County, even though President Obama carried it by 100,000 votes. Last night, he lost it by,
135,000.
Somebody on your editorial page at The Observer essentially said that that he was naive, that Pat McCrory went to Raleigh and was naive and then learned how to play the game, but he went too far and played the game too much toward the Republican conservatives. You agree with that?
Yeah, the Republican legislators, and Tim would agree with this, I'm sure, they are much more conservative than Governor McCrory is.
Yes.
But they kind of tied his hands on a lot of issues, including HB2.
Because guess where those Republican legislators come from? Rural counties.
Yes, rural counties.
The leaders are from rural areas. And, you know, the few suburban moderate Republicans like Charlie Jeter aren't in the legislature anymore.
Well, I think I just want to go back and say that Tim is so right, and we've all said this. He really, Pat McCrory was defeated by the amalgam of Moral Monday, Voting Rights Act, access to abortion, Keith Scott. I think all these things, he was the face of all these things. And that's what really led Pat McCrory to be very unpopular. I remember when he was on the Today Show, Meet the Press, and Chuck Todd was asking him questions about HB2. And Pat McCrory just seemed stunned. He really didn't know how to defend himself, but I don't think he knew that he even had to defend himself.
But if that's
and that's a naivete.
If the governor was defeated by the Moral Monday people, it didn't take down ballot. Tim, how has the complexion of the legislature or the makeup of it, liberal, Democrat, Republican, changed at all?
No, not really. And that's the amazing part about this is that they're keeping their supermajorities. I think if you would have asked people yesterday morning, I said people would have thought maybe that the House, they would lose their supermajority. So it sets it up. I mean, some people might even argue that Roy Cooper is going to be lame duck governor before he even gets in office. With these supermajorities, what can he do? And so does he become just a sort of a spokesperson for the left and trying to prevent other things publicly? I mean, there's not going to be a lot he can do. Or does he try to just moderate and work together well with them? But we've seen the news releases from Senate President Pro Tem Phil Berger and House Speaker Tim Moore just ridiculing now Attorney General Roy Cooper for not, you know, doing these lawsuits. So I don't know how that relationship works if this moves forward. And not to mention, one thing people aren't talking about, there were some remarkable changes in the Council of State as well. For instance, the Superintendent of Public Instruction.
Yes, yep.
A lot of people thought June Atkinson was a firewall for Republican education initiatives. Well, now we have a young, new Republican in there. So what happens with all that? I mean, it is a new day all across this country.
So now, Richard Burr, a Republican, won his third term as United States Senator. Is that due to his incumbency, the weakness of the Deborah Ross campaign, or Donald Trump's coattails?
I don't think anybody can really argue that Deborah Ross's campaign was necessarily weak. I think, frankly, it far exceeded expectations, especially given the fact that I would argue as late as yesterday, a decent chunk of North Carolinians probably still didn't know who she was. What they knew is she was running against Richard Burr and that she was a Democrat. And at the end of the day, she was a well-funded campaign, but it just,
But the Democrats across the country had the chance mm-hmm. to take back the Senate, and they did not. Why?
Well, I think you have to look at the Trump vote.
Yeah.
You know, people who came out to vote for him voted for the Republican Senate candidates.
Well, so that means it's not only anger and frustration and the fact that they hate Hillary Clinton, they don't like Democrats.
Well, I think with the Senate, it's gotten a lot more high profile. And this is just my speculation here. But I think particularly with the Senate, Republicans were voting for Republican senators for a simple reason. The Senate confirmed Supreme Court nominees to go sit on the bench. And I think given all of the news that has flown out, I mean, after the death of Scalia and all the fighting over whether or not, President Barack Obama's choice of Merrick Garland would even get a hearing and all that, I think voters actually suddenly became hyper aware, Republican voters in particular, of just who controls the Senate, because that will decide the Supreme Court seats as they come.
Well, that's in the context of all these divisive social issues. And that gets back to, do we have a culture war? I think, too, Deborah Ross was not, I don't know how far down, but she was not the first choice, the second choice, or the third choice of the Democratic
right.
Party to run. And I just think at the end, the ACLU and moniker that, you know, that defeated her when we have these social issues.
Hmm. Let's go back to the fact that Republican Mark Johnson has beaten June Atkinson for state superintendent of education. What will that mean? If she was the firewall for Republican education ideas, what will happen? What will change?
Do you notice there's always a lull when you ask a question, and we're always like, okay.
Tim?
I think we'll continue to see school choice issues come to the forefront with less resistance. I think we'll continue to see them to try to do more with less within the Department of Public Instruction, potentially. Will we see some testing changes finally in North Carolina, although June Atkinson did support that. I think we might see more changes in curriculum. When you're talking about things like, Common Core, that's still being debated in a lot of manners. So I think there's some, again, where I hate to keep using this word, but cumulative, not major changes necessarily, but slowly changing it towards the conservative bent when it comes to education.
And we're going to have a new attorney general in this state. Do we know yet whether it's going to be Josh Stein or Buck Newton? Because it was 50-50 at midnight last night. And if these results that I'm looking at on my computer right now are right, it's still 50-50 with about, 20,000 vote difference between the two of them.
And Josh Stein is on top right now
as we speak.
So that race is probably headed for a recount, too.
A recount.
I would think so.
Well, here's the one thing, and I need to go back and look at the statute. Tim, you might know this better than I do, but the actual recount rules are half a percentage point or 10,000 votes, whichever is less. So by my reading of that statute, actually, Josh Stein will win.
Yeah. We have a Republican now who will be running the Treasury, the state Treasury. Dale Falwell beat Dan Blue III. You know these people up in Raleigh, Tim, and I know Dan Blue you certainly know well. What will this mean?
Dale Falwell will get his fine tooth comb, and he will go through every bit of that department. I've never met somebody so particular and so thorough in what he does, and I don't mean that in a good or bad way, but I'll put it this way. When he comes in and does an interview with me, he comes in, our desk almost collapses because he has so much paperwork and props with him. I think, you know, he's talked about getting the pension back in shape. I think we're going to see a move to get away from so much private management funds and fees. I think we're going to see a lot of change at the bottom line. Of course, he has a state health plan issue, too, which is that funding is an issue as well. So I think we're going to see a huge change. It'll be interesting to see how the State Employees Association, Scenic, works with him as well.
And although it doesn't seem...
Well, and it's strange. Let me just play off that. Okay. Scenic actually endorsed him because they are against the fee. So this is one of those strange moments where we don't have public unions in North Carolina, but basically what is a union picked the Republican.
And it doesn't seem like it when I write the check, but evidently North Carolina has among the lowest car insurance rates in the country. And yet last night, if this holds true, we're going to have a new insurance commissioner, Republican Mike Causey, who at the moment is leading Wayne Goodwin, who is the incumbent. It's still 50-50, but he leads by about 40,000, 39,000 votes. Why did that happen?
I would be a millionaire if I could figure out what happened last night. I will tell you, I think, you know, it's a crapshoot when you talk about these down-ballot races, and there's a drop-off in some of these races as well. I do think it's going to mean big change potentially. Mike Causey wants to, you know, do more with private industries. He wants to potentially get rid of the rate bureau, which is gets a little wonky, but that would be a massive change in how North Carolina does business with insurance companies. So, you know, maybe they did want a sea of change about how it's done, even though the rates are good, as you mentioned, with auto rates. But I just think it was part of the political process last night, probably more than Mike Causey as a candidate.
Republicans have long criticized the media. Donald Trump was merciless with the media. Do we need to do some navel-gazing in the media going forward in this new world we live in?
I think we always do navel-gazing after an election, and this year will be no different. And there will be a lot of, you know, what the, you know, what's news, what people report, how we report, that'll all come under a microscope.
I think in particular, though, the pundit class is going to get a big, long look. When you look at, you know, all the controversies with Donna Brazile and CNN, Corey Lewandowski and CNN, some of the people that have been regular, you know, paid pundits, frankly, they popped up in WikiLeaks or have direct ties, active ties to campaigns. And I think people are starting to say that's not a pundit, that is a placed operative, that's not going to fly.
As Mama Cass used to say, there's a new world coming. I don't know where that reference came from, but I thought I had to use it. Dr. Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, Dr. Susan Roberts from Davidson College, Jim Morrill from the Charlotte Observer, Tim Boyum from Time Warner Cable News, and our own Tom Bullock from WFAE. Thank you all for the